Congresswoman Corrine Brown is served with a federal subpoena. Public defender Matt Shirk says he'll run for a third term. And graduation rates inch upward here on the First Coast. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9 and now never miss a show. Subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable, the first one of 2016, and what a busy news week it's been. Lots to discuss. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a national expert on dyslexia gives a free talk in Jacksonville tonight for parents. We'll have details. Plus, the new online book series, All the Angels Come, telling the tale of this city. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, it's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly roundtable here today. Larry Hannon of the Florida Times-Union, good morning.
Good to be here.
Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Claire Goforth, writer at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
And A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Happy Orthodox Christmas.
Oh, that's right.
Well, they changed the calendar, didn't they?
Lots of news to discuss, from Matt Shirk's announcement on this program that he will seek a third term, to the latest details of Mayor Curry's pension debt reduction plan and more. But we're going to begin with the week's top story. Congresswoman Corrine Brown has been served with a federal subpoena. Her barbecue dinner and political strategy session at Bono's the other night was cut short when federal agents served her instead with a subpoena. That's according to two people who were there and as reported by multiple media outlets. Details about the subpoena still are a mystery, although there's much discussion that it might have something to do with the Congresswoman's longstanding tradition of quick picks that are her, those are her endorsements of political candidates. We're going to begin the hour with an in-depth discussion of this, our top story. We want your calls. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect and email and tweet the show. Larry Hannon, in a prepared statement Wednesday, Congresswoman Brown said her 5th congressional district is under attack through the redistricting process and is now under siege by other political forces. She calls this a tangential investigation.
Yes. And to be clear, we have no clue what this investigation is. We don't know if she's the target or if they just want her as a witness going after someone else. The fact that she was subpoenaed suggests that she may not be the target. But what's, you know, obviously, you know, she's putting all this in with the redistricting, the fact that they've completely changed her district. She is trying to bill herself as the person who is fighting against the establishment. And, you know, she's a survivor. She's been doing this for 20 years. I wouldn't be surprised if she actually is able to generate some sympathy for this.
A.G. Gankarski, you reported at the website Florida Politics, full disclosure, I freelance for that website as well, that a Jacksonville city councilman may also be ensnared in this federal investigation.
Yes, and he's not talking, and that's sort of consistent with Corrine Brown's approach to this. Her 5-sentence statement did not address the particulars of the investigation, did not address the specific charges, did not address the rumors that have been going around Jacksonville City Hall and city politics all week regarding this issue. It was just basically deny, deny, deny. And, you know, she's going to have to read a statement on the Florida U.S. Congress explaining that she was subpoenaed, and I believe that statement has to indicate why she's subpoenaed. And if it does involve other politicians, they're going to be subject to the same scrutiny. You know, every media outlet in the city has been trying to get quotes from Corrine Brown, trying to get quotes from other people relevant to the investigation. You're getting stonewalling that, you know, reminds some observers of Richard Nixon and Watergate, you know, of other scandals gone by. And she's not taking control of the narrative. She's just resorting to her familiar memes that, you know, she's, you know, being treated unfairly and it's about redistricting and so on and so forth. But, you know, if you're being subpoenaed for something, you know, as a public servant, she owes the people an explanation of what it is.
The number to join the show is 549-2937. Claire, go forth. Your thoughts.
I think that it's really intelligent of her to frame the issue as a redistricting, because if it is quick picks, there's a lot of people locally within her own party that have long been resentful of that. I mean, she wields more power in the Democratic Party locally than any other politician, Republican or Democrat. I mean, she has so much control over politics in Jacksonville. I don't imagine that there's any Republican that does this has the same influence over things that are going on even outside of her own district.
But what's weird now is that it's really the Republicans who need her more than the Democrats. A lot of Democrats want her out now. They view her as an albatross. They're happy the district is being changed, and they would like to get someone younger who has more of a future in statewide office to get that position. It's really the Republicans you talk to who desperately want her to stay. They will tell mm-hmm. you that she's the best representative in this area at getting stuff from Washington, and the thought of losing her actually scares them.
Tim Gibbons, it's remarkable the degree to which Kareem Brown's allies are by and large outside of Duval County.
They are.
They're in Washington. They're not in Jacksonville.
Right.
Although the local Republican leadership likes her.
Right, but she's made enough enemies here locally, but as Larry said, you know, Corinne does deliver. As Claire said though, in some ways the redistricting thing actually was a gift to Corinne that she could use it and go, "Oh no, this is all about redistricting," when I'm betting it has absolutely nothing to do with that, but it gives her that hobby horse to ride again.
AG.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality of it. I mean, and this issue coming right when it does, it blocks local Republicans from being, you know, helpful to her in any meaningful way. You had people who are willing to talk, you know, semi on record about how important Corinne was to this district. Now with this hanging over her head, with her inadvertent handling of it, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, how much help can they be? And this sort of moves the battle to, well, is she going to run again? Is she vulnerable? Should somebody else from Jacksonville run for the seat? And it also brings Andrew Gillum, the Tallahassee mayor. You know, he had kind of moved toward ruling it out, and now he's ruling back in.
If you're ruling it out last week or 2 weeks ago, is very different from now.
If you got five Democrats running from Jacksonville, why not jump in?
And the names that have been circulated are, for example, Audrey Gibson, Mia Jones, even former Mayor Alvin Brown. Those names have all been floated to see as possible contenders for her congressional seat. Claire. Well,
you know, I think there's a lot of people that would like to see a new face in that particular seat. Corinne Brown has done a lot of good for Jacksonville, but maybe it's time to see somebody else.
I don't know if Gibson and Hill are new faces, or Mia Jones for that matter. I mean, they're established quantities. Yeah. And you know, that's where Andrew Gillum comes in. He's 36. He's young. He's vibrant. You know, he speaks the language of the 21st century, and you know, he's got appeal well beyond this district.
Right. When you look at the Jacksonville possible contenders, all of them are longtime players.
What about the notion that because redistricting has put Kareem Brown in a more vulnerable position, and as she's fighting to keep her current configuration, that, as you said a moment ago, those that for many years have resented her power in the African-American community perhaps dropped a dime on Kareem Brown at the federal level.
I find it interesting when and where the subpoena was served. I mean, this is an interest. It's almost a public embarrassment perp walk sort of way of serving the subpoena.
Yeah, but they know who her lawyers are. They could have very easily served it. They could have called her lawyer and say, "We're serving her. Let us know when we can." And they could have done it very privately. Instead, they did it in the most public way imaginable.
Well, they followed her from the gym, from what one person told me. She basically came from working out to the strategy meeting for a Florida Health Solutions PAC. And, you know, they're sitting in Bono's just eating and talking about things like, you know, the supervisors of elections not counting their petitions fast enough. And then these two white dudes walk into Norwood Bono's, which, you know, the guy said was anomalous in itself, and, you know, served a subpoena.
And so, as you've reported, this is a politician that's been subjected to a level of, frankly, ridicule that other politicians in this area really haven't faced.
Yeah, and, you know, part of that is the way she handles the media, which is, you know, pretty maladroit. She's been on your show. She hung up on you during an interview. And it wasn't exactly a combative interview. You just ask a follow-up question. She's like, "I got to go." And, you know, that's the way her machine, and it is a
Thanks
machine.
Thanks for reminding me of that,
yeah.
By the way.
Yeah, the machine handles it that way. I mean, you know, if you ask an adversarial question at a press conference where, you know, Senator Gibson and, you know, Representative Jones are, and, you know, they will say something to you. They'll say, "You're derailing this press conference." So, you know, it's a different level of enforcement than you get with some other politicians and political machines.
Maybe over the years, she's just become so accustomed to having that kind of power that, you know, she feels entitled to draw these lines in the sand. You're not going to go beyond this line. I am Kareem Brown.
Well, that is part of the redistricting thing when she talks about, you know, her district where, I mean, obviously it's her district, but the idea of the minority representation is a very real thing, but she's not the only one who can provide that. But after 20 years, that seems to be the mindset.
Let's go to your calls now. The number to join our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. Our panelists today, Tim Gibbons, Larry Hannon, Claire Goforth, and A.G. Gankarski. Bobby on the north side. Hi, Bobby. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I was wanting to speak on the pension thing, but I'll weigh in on Ms. Brown. She's a survivor. She'll be around. You're not going to see the last of Corinne until she decides she wants to do something else with her life. But more importantly, I'm concerned about this pension extension. If the mayor, if the politicians want to run to the referendum for the HRO, but they won't let the voters vote on extending the tax, that says a lot about our so-called leadership in this town. And I really think that any extension of that sales tax should go before the voters.
Okay, Bobby. You know what? We'll talk about the pension story in just a moment. That's another big talker from the week. Thanks for the call. And the number to join is 549-2937. Larry.
He does make a good point, which is, you know, we talk about, well, if Corinne doesn't run, she is running. I mean, there is no way she is retiring. Now, it's possible she may go to the Orlando district and run there, though I think that's unlikely. But she is going to be a candidate no matter what happens for re-election.
She probably knows this more than definitely more than I do. But what is her base of support in Orlando? I mean, I think of her so much as a Jacksonville power base. But would she have the
It's similar. The problem is there are three people with their own bases already in that primary. Mm-hmm. So she wouldn't be going in as the incumbent. She'd be going in as one of four people, and she'd be, you know, from Jacksonville, so you get the carpetbagger claim. She's got a subpoena hanging over her head. You know, there are a lot of issues that mitigate against that. So, you know, she's been hinting in comments to media that her preference is to stay up here.
All right. And also making headlines this week, Fourth Circuit Public Defender Matt Shirk confirming on this show yesterday that he's seeking a third term in office. Shirk says he's putting the scandals of his administration behind him as he seeks the voters' forgiveness. Now, a grand jury last year recommended that Shirk step down after revelations in the Florida Times Union that he sent suggestive text messages to his employees, young female employees, and deleted public records, among other eyebrow-raising practices. Shirk says the crisis led him to a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Let's listen to Shirk's interview yesterday.
You know, I'm not infallible. I'm a human. I've made mistakes, and I've owned up to those mistakes, and I'm moving forward. We have an incredible positive record in the office.
Now, retired County Judge Charles Cofer has also filed to run for the office. We want your calls right now on Matt Shirk's confession that he's made mistakes, but that he's moving forward and he wants the public's vote. As he seeks another term as public defender, give us a call, 549-2937. Larry Hannon, you broke that story. Your thoughts this morning.
It's been obvious for months Shirk was going to run. The hires he's been making, the statements he's been doing, he clearly was not going to retire and go away. And it's important to remember, before this scandal broke, he was seen as having a very bright political future. People saw him as a future state attorney, a future mayor, widely seen as the public defender just being a stepping stone for something else. And you know, I think, you know, he seems to have healed his marriage. He and his wife are together again. They seem to be doing well. And, you know, people who think he has no chance of being reelected are wrong. He has a decent chance. He's the incumbent. He's running in an election where there's not good, you know, it's going to be a presidential election. It's going to be an open Senate seat. And has better ties to the Republican Party than Cofer does. There's a fairly strong argument that Cofer isn't a real Republican. And if Shirk can get sort of the tribal loyalty of Republicans, I think he has a shot to win.
Tim Gibbons.
I always find it interesting when politicians basically unilaterally declare, okay, this is done. I've you know, made amends and we've moved on. And I think voters aren't always as quick to move on. But in this case, I mean, the scandal was a couple years ago. It was kind of a self-contained thing. He didn't resign once the grand jury suggested he did. And at that point, what else are you going to do?
Claire Goforth, Matt Shirk certainly wouldn't be the first politician to be caught out in inappropriate behavior in office. At the same time, the American public has, over the years, demonstrated an extraordinary capacity for forgiveness if they feel that the politician is sincere in his contrition. What do you think?
Yeah, that is a good point, and I definitely agree that the American people are willing to forgive a politician who's had some indiscretions, particularly marital ones, because that is admittedly outside of the job. Now, there are some, there's been some wrongdoing here that was inside of the office.
Inside the office.
Absolutely. But I think that he does have an uphill battle to rehabilitate his image. I think he wants to go out on a high note. But I do think another interesting development is that recently the state attorney, Angela Corey, has been seen at events with Judge Kofor, events at which Matt Shirk attended, but she's been sitting with Judge Kofor. So the indications are that she's throwing her support behind Kofor, which could be a good or a bad thing. Angela Corey, some people love her, some people hate her. There are very strong opinions about
yes,
her.
Yes. Yesterday on this program, AG, Matt Shirk was unequivocal that he and Angela Corey are no longer as chummy, perhaps, as they once were, that the relationship is quite adversarial. I think it's fair to say that she won't be throwing any support behind his reelection bid.
Yeah, I mean, Corey's camp has said they're staying out of this officially, for what that's worth. You know, and that's really the thing. I mean, you don't necessarily want the district attorney's, you know, or state attorney's endorsement as a public defender.
Right.
It's something that Charles Kofor brought up in an interview with me. He's like, the symbiosis was unappealing. Also unappealing, you know, from people I heard from yesterday with Shirk's performance on your program. People were saying it was painful to listen to. They were saying it was unconvincing. They didn't buy the Jesus conversion. You know, they didn't buy that narrative. And maybe it was a matter of delivery. Maybe it was a matter of timing. You know, but it's something where there is a real trust issue that Shirk has built up. And Kofor has also brought up time and time again that Shirk's office is not running well. He sat in, you know, Kofor being a judge, has sat in when people from his office have been in trials and they've missed opportunities. They missed arguments they could have made. And there's a really strong argument that his office is not doing the representation that the people of Jacksonville deserve.
That would be the interesting bit if that becomes the issue in the fight, because obviously, the elephant in the room is the personal conduct, but if you can make the case that he's not doing the job well, people are less keen
to
forgive that.
Well, and what it comes down to is you're defending clients who cannot afford their own attorney. Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about. Matt Shirk said on this program yesterday that they have increased their acquittal rate by something like 70%. And these are people that can't afford their own lawyer. These are people that need a credible defense attorney. And so when you vote for this office, you need to weigh that. Often these are poor defendants. These are defendants that might have been wrongly accused of a crime, or if they are guilty, they still deserve the right to counsel. So public defender's offices are underfunded, understaffed. They need often there are talented attorneys that work there for a few years and then go on to do something else. You need to think about the fact that that the way the office is run is performing a public service. Larry.
One thing that's already becoming obvious is Shirk is not going to have the support of the legal community. Now, the legal community has never really liked him. They disliked him from the moment he beat Bill White 8 years ago. But what we're seeing is the most prominent attorneys in town are all gravitating towards Kofor. Some of them even urged him to run before he announced.
And why is that?
They don't think he's a very good public defender. A lot of them are friends with Bill White and some of the old assistant public defenders who Shirk fired when he took office.
For the record, he disputed that. He said most of them resigned when he was here yesterday.
Yeah, and that's true. But a lot of them jumped because they thought they were going to be fired when he took over. You know, which is common. You know, when Angela Corey came in, a lot of Harry Shorstein's old hands resigned immediately as well because they didn't want to work for him. So
we want your calls on the top stories of the week. The number to join the show, 549-2937. We took a call a moment ago about Jacksonville's pension debt, the huge expense for its police and firefighter pension plan. According to the mayor's proposal to fix it, could jump by another $16 million next year. That's an increase of more than 10%. Let's talk about this. The city paid more than $150 million to the police and fire pension fund in this year's budget. That will go up to about $169 million in next year's budget. That's the highest amount Jacksonville's ever paid to the pension plan. Mayor Lenny Curry unveiled a plan this week that would use an extension of the Better Jacksonville plan's half-cent sales tax to pay down the debt and ease the stress on the city's budget. He says that's the way to figure out a way through this. The improving economy, AG, is bringing more money into city coffers. This half-cent sales tax plan, according to Mayor Curry, is probably the best solution. Your thoughts?
Well, one thing to note is that the half-cent sales tax, which, you know, John Delaney says is a new tax, not an extension of the BJP tax, Better Jacksonville Plan, you know, that is contingent on, you know, city employees, all six unions, accepting the defined contribution model, 401k for those, you know, who want a different term. And, you know, it's contingent with collective bargaining, it's contingent with both houses in Tallahassee, it's contingent with, you know, support of Rick Scott. So there are a lot of factors here. So it's not as simple as, you know, if you build it, they will come. It's like there's going to be a lot of political heavy lifting. This is a big test for Lenny Curry and his machine. Can they go to Tallahassee and get this done? Can they get it through council? I mean, supermajority works. I mean, the caller mentioned that he wanted a referendum instead of a supermajority. But, you know, John Delaney told me that either one would work for Better Jacksonville Plan, and that's true with this also.
Tim Gibbons, the mayor, saying he can use his influence, his contacts in Tallahassee to help get this done.
It really is going to be, you know, does Lenny deliver sort of thing here, where he spent many years as the Republican Party head developing these contacts, and this is where he gets to see if it pays off. Because it does, as AG says, it's not an easy thing. I'm actually even more interested in the collective bargaining bit, because that's not something where he has any juice in particular. The unions have already rejected this idea of defined contribution plans once, and we'll be interested to see if it, you know, what they do again.
Claire.
I think that if Mayor Curry is successful at extending the Better Jacksonville plan and paying that, using that money to pay down the pension debt, it will be a huge notch in his belt when he goes to run again, which I'm sure that he probably intends to do. At this point, you know, with HRO coming through, there are some issues that people are a bit surprised that he hasn't, you know, his far right base is surprised that he hasn't come out against it on certain elements of it.
I don't know if he has a far right base or not.
Caller said that was really interesting, is that idea that if he pushes this through but goes to a referendum on the HRO, that's very telling.
What about that? The caller Bobby saying if there's a referendum on human rights, shouldn't there be a referendum on all of us paying more in taxes to pay down the pension?
Well, you know, you can make the argument there should be a referendum on everything. You know,
let the people speak.
Yeah, I mean, we elect 19 people to city council to represent this city, and you know, it seems as though there's suddenly this urge for a referendum for everything. You know, my view is let the council vote. If you don't like the way they vote, vote your representative out the next time they're up and vote the mayor out. It's,
you know, but this is the thing, though. The referendum is not the mayor's plan. That's Bill Gulliver's plan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Greg Anderson's going to have a committee of the whole, you know, deliberating the Gulliver referendum bill, the Tommy Azuri actual legislation, you know, which is not a charter change.
And now we're back to the human rights ordinance.
Yeah, but you just started saying that's not the mayor's plan. I don't know if doesn't appear the mayor has a plan.
The mayor has not endorsed the Gulliver referendum bill. I mean, everybody has asked him about it.
Right.
You know, people, when it came out, it's like, oh, is this the mayor's plan? He's doing a back channel thing. It's like, no, and the mayor is still, he may introduce a third bill.
He hasn't really endorsed anything at this point on HRO.
Neither did Alvin Brown, though, you know, when it came out the last
before the end of 2015, Mayor Lenny Curry said he would be coming out with a position in 2016. So
I got 12 more months.
Yeah. Well, he says it's going to be in January.
So it's at some point in this month, we do hope to see where Mayor Curry is on this. Let's go now to Linda in Deerwood. Hi, Linda, you're on the air.
Yes. Excuse me.
Go ahead.
I think the proposal by the mayor is very interesting. It sounds like he could pay entire vote for Delaney, and maybe that's why he got his support, except at least Mayor Delaney went out and sold the idea to the public. Okay, he sold that this is going to be good for the city, and he did give us the alleged opportunity to weigh in. So he took the idea. And isn't that interesting? This is really, if we aren't going to extinguish the tax increase, this is a tax increase. So let's call it, Mayor Brown would have never gotten away with this idea. I think it's interesting that Mayor Payton is doing this. But I think if he's going to take that page out of the playbook, he needs to go the same route. Sell it to the people. Sell it to us why we, because we're going to be the ones paying for it, not him, and why this is a good idea. And then, so he can say, I've got the support of the people to resolve the pension deal this way.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Linda. Two points she made. A, Does Lenny Curry have to sell this more? And B, is she right that Alvin Brown couldn't have gotten away with this?
I think she's right on both instances. Curry has to see, Curry has, it's so far been an inside game. At some point, he's got to get to the public and convince them this is a good thing.
Yeah, but not through a referendum. I mean, a referendum would not pass. It's one thing to say, give us more money to build a library and build roads and do stuff. It's something else to say this debt that was, caused by bad decisions by city council, now pay more to pay that down. That's a way, way harder road.
Here's the reality. I mean, Curry's got a certain amount of political capital, as Alvin Brown did when he came in. Alvin Brown didn't use his political capital very effectively. Lenny Curry's got a few more initiatives like this they can push through this way. And this one is very important to him because you look at the pension burden. It's going to approach $200 million soon in a billion-dollar budget. You look at your crumbling roads. You look at how it takes police officers 45 minutes to get to a burglary scene. All of this is a function of the fact there's not enough capital to do basic city functions. So, I mean, that's the leadership role there. And, Curry is investing a significant chunk of political capital in this. And it's like he's only got a few of these long bombs in a term. This is one he's chosen.
And it obviously is a tax increase. I mean, just to be clear, it's a tax that would go away that he would keep, but it doesn't have the political hit of going to a referendum and forcing it through as a new tax. If you can get it through Tallahassee, yes, it's a tax increase, but without the pain of doing
it. Jim at the Beaches writes, we've got a bed tax for stadium renovations because the bed tax can only be used on certain things. But change laws so the Better Jacksonville plan tax can be extended and used for something else. It's interesting to see when they will seek law changes to support a particular cause.
Well, a lot of cities have pension issues. So if we could fix ours, that might bring people here as tourists. So maybe we can do the bed tax to fix the pension and then attract tourists.
They can come see the John Keane Museum.
Right. Let's mention quickly that the percentage of high school graduates in Duval County and Florida went up again this year, placing the state at a 12-year high, but still short of the national average, according to new data released by the Florida Department of Education. Across the country, about 82% of high school students walk at graduation in cap and gown. Here in Duval, the number of graduates went up by about 2.6 percentage points to 76.6%. That's an increase of more than 13% over the last 5 years. Claire Goforth, Superintendent Nicolai Vitti, says the district now ranks first among the seven largest urban districts in the number of African-American high school graduates.
That is extremely good news for Superintendent Vitti, who's taken a lot of hits recently about his management style. Regardless of how abrasive you are, you can still be an effective leader. And I don't know that the superintendent really is due all of the credit for the increase, but certainly his leadership has got to have something to do with it. Maybe it's the economic indicators probably are part and parcel with this increase, but it's good news for Duval County. I'd like to see more improvement on this.
It's also impressive because, let's face it, the testing, the Florida testing situation right now is such a joke because of all these changes. You can't really take a lot from the tests at the moment. So the graduation rate becomes even more impressive because that's something that isn't reliant on how the state is doing testing. So the fact that it's going up suggests things are going well.
And if they're willing to sit through all those tests for yet another year to graduate, that's just a sign that they're really committed.
Yeah. You know, one augury of future trends is actually the fact that you have the Jacksonville Journey back, and you've got Vitti and Mayor Curry working together on that. Because, you know, the graduation rate is up because they're doing a better job without outreach to at-risk kids. And, you know, at-risk kids are a function of Jacksonville Journey. There are a lot of things like the library early access program, LEAP, things like that to ensure that people have better educational outcomes in at-risk communities. So, you know, hopefully this trend continues.
One of the challenges with the Jacksonville Journey has always been it's a kind of a long play of helping people earlier. But graduation rate is one of those kind of quick benefits that you can see.
All right. Lots of news to discuss. And finally, we've got our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week across the state. I always say there's never a shortage of material, but actually this week there was a shortage of material. I don't know. It's just kind of a quiet week as we start off 2016. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Just one story for the week. It's kind of cool, though. Whatever disparaging cliche you've heard about the lowly dime, dime a dozen, you've been nickel and dimed, well, it's not true of this dime. One coin that went to auction Thursday night in Tampa sold for almost $2 million. That's right, the 1894 S dime was struck at the San Francisco Mint Only 24 were made and only 9 still exist.
That's not a very effective mint.
In fact, so few of these dimes were made that year because the country was in a recession, so more dimes weren't needed. Heritage Auctions, which conducted this auction, said an experienced collector who wishes to remain anonymous outbid 15 others. The winner paid $1,997,500 for this one thin dime. The coin previously belonged to a private owner who also remains anonymous. It was auctioned during the Florida United Numismatists show.
I was waiting for you to try to say that word.
There is such a thing as a numismatist. I guess this is like a coin collector.
Technical word for coin. Yeah.
Let's use it in Scrabble. Say it five times because it feels dirty.
There's also a lot of interest in what happened to these other missing 1894 series dimes. In an effort to track them down, Heritage Auctions is offering a $10,000 reward if you have one. Mark Borkart, senior numismatist, says they could be in your desk drawer, they could be in your bank box. Look almost anywhere and one might show up.
Wait, there's one over there. AJ, quick grab it.
I'm going to explore some parking meters and see if they're in there.
Call your grandparents right now. You just never know. Thanks to our media panel, Claire Goforth, Tim Gibbons, Larry Hannon, and A.G. Gankarski. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you,
Melissa.
Later on, the new online book series, All the Angels Come, and the story it tells about Jacksonville. Also, History Channel host and author Brad Meltzer. But up next, dyslexia expert Susan Barton visits this area with advice for parents and teachers.
Hi, this is Michael Feldman, and thanks to WJCT and the Florida Theater. What Do You Know, Y'all? Is coming to Jacksonville on Saturday, February 20th. We're flying down to check out all 22 miles of beach, maybe do us some fish camping. Join us, won't you? Tickets are available at the Florida Theater box office, by phone at 904-355-2787, or online at floridatheater.com. We'll see you there.
Sponsored in part by Folio Media House.
I'm Ira Flatow. This year's Consumer Electronics Show was a buzz about self-driving cars. Names like Google, Tesla, Apple, Uber, Lyft, even BlackBerry. Join me on Science Friday for a look at the road ahead for driverless autos. Plus a guy who collects quack medical devices because they're beautiful. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen, or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Welcome back. Well, New York Times bestselling author Brad Meltzer is known for writing thrillers for adults and also for his History Channel show, Decoded. But Meltzer has also found success writing a series of books for children. His series, Ordinary People Change the World, spotlights everyone from Rosa Parks to Abraham Lincoln to Amelia Earhart. Meltzer's latest book is about Martin Luther King Jr. He'll appear this Sunday at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach to talk about this new title, I Am Martin Luther King Jr. Meltzer gave us a preview. Take a listen. Brad Meltzer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is a great book for children to be reading as we approach the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. And you wrote it for kids. You wanted to offer your own children something to read, a different kind of hero.
Yeah, I was tired of my own kids looking at reality TV show stars and loudmouth athletes and thinking that that's a hero. And I said, you know, I do a History Channel TV show. My thrillers, like The President and Shadow, are filled with history. But I said, I have so many better heroes to draw from for them. And so I said, I'm going to do an illustrated biography series, like children's books, but with real-life stories. And we don't just tell the stories of when they're famous. We started with I'm Amelia Earhart. And I'm Abraham Lincoln. But we don't just tell you the stories when they're famous. We also show you them when they're kids. So in I Am Amelia Earhart, it says, And true story, that when Amelia Earhart was 7 years old, she built a homemade roller coaster in her backyard. My daughter isn't impressed that Amelia Earhart flies across the Atlantic Ocean. Everyone flies across the Atlantic Ocean today. But when I tell her that when she was 7, Amelia Earhart built a homemade roller coaster and traveled down and put a wooden crate with roller skating wheels on the bottom and smashed through the air, true story, my daughter's like, Amelia Earhart is bold and she's daring and most important, she's fun. And now Amelia Earhart is alive again. And I said, that's the kind of books I want to write. So we've now done I'm Rosa Parks, I'm Albert Einstein, I'm Jackie Robinson. We've done Lucille Ball and Helen Keller, and now we're doing, finally, I Am Martin Luther King Jr.
And how does writing children's books compare to writing books for adults? Of course, you've written New York Times bestsellers for grown-ups, and you're a History Channel host. It's different writing for kids, isn't it?
I hate to say it. You know, it's just, listen, you have to be clear of, like, language and things like that, and, you know, obviously at different layers, but a good story is a good story. You know, when I Am Martin Luther King Jr. opens, it opens with this story, which is that when Dr. King was just 6 years old, one of his dearest friends was a little boy who was white. They used to play together and have fun together, and one day the boy comes to Dr. King and says, my father doesn't want me playing with you anymore. And all rejected, can't understand why. He goes back to his parents, and Dr. King's parents tell him, it's because you're black and he's white. And Dr. King, at 6 years old, is so mad. He says he wants to hate that dad, and he wants to hate that boy. And his parents tell him this lesson. They said, don't hate him. They said, show him love. That the world is better off with more love in it than more hate in it. And his mother tells him never to let anyone make you feel like you're lesser than who you are. And, man, those lessons are with Dr. King forever. So that story is, yes, it's a story that you can tell an adult, but it's also one that any child can relate to, because we all know what it's like to be rejected or someone not wanting to play with us on a certain day. And now Dr. King becomes a human being, and now we can take him anywhere. Now kids will follow him, and they understand him, and they see him. And that's what the book is really about when you read I Am Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you. People can come out and meet you in person this Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach, and have their kids come, too, and pick up copies of I Am Martin Luther King Jr. Brad Meltzer, a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
Again, that's History Channel host and best-selling author Brad Meltzer. You can meet him this Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Bookmark. That's on First Street in Neptune Beach. Well, tonight, an international expert on dyslexia speaks in Jacksonville at a free seminar about the symptoms and causes of the disorder. Dyslexia affects kids' ability to read or interpret words, letters, and symbols, but it doesn't affect their intelligence. In fact, kids with dyslexia are really smart. Our own superintendent, Nikolai Vidi, is dyslexic, for example. Now, tonight, expert Susan Barton is coming to town on behalf of the DePaul School of Northeast Florida. Her presentation will look at why kids struggle with dyslexia and the best ways to help them succeed and improve their spelling, reading, and writing. Head of school, Dr. Andrea Cummings, is here now in studio with a preview. Dr. Cummings, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And this is happening tonight, a free event at the Jacksonville Marriott at South Point. Susan Barton knows so much about this, so there's a lot of excitement that she's coming to talk with parents, yes?
Absolutely. Susan actually created the Barton series, which is very useful to teachers to assist students with dyslexia and other learning differences.
What is the Barton series exactly?
So it's actually specific ways of teaching students how to read using their letters, phonics, fluency, and all that, sounds, everything.
And in recent years, we've learned a lot more about dyslexia and how it affects children. It can be so frustrating for kids because often they have trouble reading, spelling. Often kids will transpose letters. They'll mm-hmm. see something, letters reversed on the page. Mm-hmm. Reading comprehension can be an issue and things like that, right?
Absolutely. It starts very early. You can actually diagnose them as early as 5 years old. And for the most part, the issue with directionality is the reason why they normally reverse letters and numbers and things like that. But those are just a few, actually, of the issues that the students are faced with. Everything from sometimes speech to their processing, auditory or visual processing. They would have issues with writing, absolutely, and comprehension would normally be.
And do we know what causes dyslexia?
Well, actually, it is neurological. It is hereditary. And specific causes, I'm not sure, because there's so many host of different reasons or research to say otherwise. But for the most part, we know it's hereditary and it is neurological.
Everyone from actor Tom Cruise to our own reveal host Al Letson has struggled with dyslexia. Plenty of famous and accomplished people have struggled with dyslexia, and they tell these incredibly wrenching stories of what it was like for them as kids in the classroom. Teachers would write them off and thought they were stupid.
Right.
And kids with dyslexia aren't stupid. They're smart.
They're really smart kids, absolutely. And you said something with regards to their intelligence. They're actually above average, average to above average intelligence. They're smart kids. They think out of the box. They're very good spatial thinkers. And so those students, actually, teaching them the way they learn is actually the key to dyslexia. And I think that's what we do the most at DePaul School. We teach our students the way they learn. Lots of multisensory teaching and multisensory techniques. Teaching them the basics of reading, letters, the foundation, sounding, in order to help them in that area.
And how does that help children? It really does make a difference in terms of helping them learn, helping them read, helping them write, helping them go on to succeed academically.
Absolutely. And we've had quite a few students who've gone on, moved on to college, graduated. We've had some who returned to DePaul School to assist students and to give them that motivation that they may need, especially those who think they cannot succeed.
So this event, as I mentioned, is free, but people that are just hearing about it do need to register.
Yes, they do need to register, and I'm not sure if it's still open because I think we're almost maxed out, but they can still try eventbrite.com, and they can go to DePaulSchool.com on our website and register there.
Again, it's Susan Barton who created the Barton Series. This is a cutting-edge program for children with dyslexia. This free talk is tonight at 5:30 at the Jacksonville Marriott at South Point. That's at Butler and I-95.
Correct.
This is sponsored by the DePaul School of Northeast Florida, hosting international dyslexia expert Susan Barton for a free informational seminar, 5:30 p.m. at the Jacksonville Marriott. Register now at depaulschool.eventbrite.com. Dr. Andrea Cummings, head of school at the DePaul School, and we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, we'll peek inside the pages of Arbis Magazine to read the new online book series, All the Angels Come. That's next.
Unemployment has fallen to just 5%, but getting it much lower, that's going to be the hard part.
I've had seasonal, like, retail jobs and lasted, like, a couple of months, but that's basically it. I've done probably, like, 150 resumes and applications.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Jobs Day, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Next time on Ask Me Another, we talk to VIP David Cross, whose TV shows tend to find fame after they're off the air.
Not appreciated in my time. I'm going to have myself killed, but in a way that I can be cryologically, right? Cryogenically, thank you.
Yeah.
There's a certain cryologic to what I said, though.
Join me, Jonathan Colton, on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Sunday mornings at 11 after Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on 89.9 WJCT.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, it's billed as an epic fairy tale for our city. The new online book series, All the Angels Come, featured in Arbus Magazine, is the brainchild of local artist and talk show host Jim Alabiso. Jim joins us now with more about this new work, featured by its diversity of characters. Hey, Jim.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, too.
So, as if you weren't already doing enough swimming the St. John's River, hosting your own show tonight with Jim Alabiso, now you've decided to write a new series. What's this all about?
I had this idea a couple of years ago from a personal experience I had outside of a local coffee shop, and I had this idea for a book, and then I thought, how cool would it be to just write it out loud and publish chapters as I go, just kind of take the risk.
Wow.
And which was very scary to begin with. But I'm getting comfortable in those shoes. It's still a bit scary, but I'm getting comfortable in those shoes. So it's a lot of fun.
This is all online.
All online at jimalabiso.com. It's called All the Angels Come. And then the piece in Arbus, which is called Apohelios, is a spinoff of that series. Apohelios means far from the sun.
What's this all about? What's the plot?
Well, the overall plot in All the Angels Come is basically when... It was actually inspired by several people that I know that are homeless on the corners of many of the streets that we know and at the beach. And I spun a tale about each one. And, you know, they're on their corners or walking the beach or doing what they do, talking out to other people and talking to themselves. But when you put them in a room together, everything they say dovetails into something that can change the city and change the world. So I wrote this epic fairy tale for Jacksonville, and people that read it and the fan base that we already have, you know, write in and they can recognize places and actually recognize people too, because a lot of the characters are inspired or named after people I know. So
you have a short excerpt from All the Angels Come that
I do.
You're going to read for us.
Sure. Some of this is hard to write and hard to read, but I'm going to read you this one. One of the characters is a woman by the name Masoyo, and she was abused by her husband. And in one of the scenes, she actually ends his life, kicks him off the curb on Riverside Avenue in front of a car. And she suffers from post-trauma. And I do want to say something about these characters, too. It's one of the things about superheroes and angels that we see in comic books and in movies is they're all pretty much vanilla. They're the same thing. You know, if you look at the Avengers cast, they're all a bunch of white guys.
Yeah.
Right? Except for Samuel Jackson.
Right.
So it's kind of like every one of these characters is somebody that you just don't expect to be your angel. And they're all different flavors, a diverse cast. One of the guys is a Latino guy from Cartagena, Colombia. The other one is this obese white woman that loves watermelon. You know, I mean, there's just all these wonderful, this cast of characters. So here, this chapter is called First Slice, and it's online. Masayo, the perpetrator, stands behind the winged statue in the park by the riverside. The wings seem to move, but she ignores the visual disturbance, finding it hard to focus at times. The sound of the river makes her dizzy. Masoyo eyes the hater boys who stop for a smoke in this too public a place. She didn't mean for Masato to fall off the curb, she thinks. He was always drunk. He stumbled like he always stumbles. Things change, like he said, and she is happy to be free. Free to take the haters of the world, and there are two in her line of sight. They are whispering about lifting a booth at the farmer's market. Easy money, one says. Masayo makes her way to the wooded end of the park by a tree and sets her weekender suitcase on the ground under a bush. She unhooks the bungee cords and feels around for Masato's Swiss golf knife, complete with a divot tool, not taking an eyes off the boys. Her focus comes and goes, but for today, for some reason, there's less going. She pockets the tool, ties one bungee back around the suitcase, and the other she wraps around her wrists. Bungees are all-purpose, perfect for strapping down stuff and to take down the life of a hater.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's beautiful stuff.
Thank you.
What's the reaction been so far?
It's been really good. I've got really great reviews so far. I don't remember what they say, but they're online. And so I'm really pleased with the reviews. I got a lot of feedback from the Arbus. So the story in Arbus is a spinoff. Two of the characters from Angels are in that. It's a mermaid story. The characters are Michael and Christina and William. William appears in both books. William was inspired by a fellow that walks the beaches, homeless guy that walks the beaches. Anybody that hangs out at Jacksonville Beach knows exactly who I'm talking about. And in his fictional life, he lost a daughter in Katrina in the shallow water. And he's a great read as well. Christina is basically inspired and named after Kristen Keene of Rethreaded, who's kind of my mermaid friend that swims with me on the sunrises every week. So, yeah.
So this is out now at jimelobiso.com.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And Tonight with Jim Alabiso, new episodes at tvjax.com.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And gosh, in your spare time, I think you're going to be working on solving the world peace problem,
I'm going to try to do that.
Yeah, you're going to work on that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
What else is going on? Have I forgotten anything?
Got a couple of really good things in Arbus. We got part two coming up in Arbus of Apo Helios, which is illustrated by John Jay of First Coast Mermaids. But we also were lucky enough to talk to Mila Firstova, who designed the cover of the Coldplay album, called Ghost Stories, and she's letting us use her Flow series as illustrations in there. And then the issue after that, she's going to be, which is the Women in Business issue for Arbus, she's going to do an interview and talk about her work with Coldplay and her new exhibition called Motherhood One, which will be in the A Gallery in London in March.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Again, it's All the Angels Come at jimelobiso.com and in Arbus Magazine. That's our show, and thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. Our theme, composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. Next on Diane Rehm, a look at the week's top national news stories. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.